KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have back on the show Larry Downes, co-author of the book Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation. Larry was on the show several years ago discussing his earlier works in these areas. I had him on discussing some work that he had done early on, right, early in terms of the writing, on how technology is changing how we think about the business world writ large. In Big Bang Disruption, we take a closer look at this problem or opportunity, right, depending on your perspective, of technologies coming at companies and at society relatively quickly, and how businesses both can cultivate, in the first half of the book, an environment that allows that, and then how businesses can react to it. And so in Big Bang Disruption, Larry and Paul is not joining us today on the show, talk about both the background for how we got to this point and then what businesses should do to address these disruptions. In the book, and we're going to define some terms, Larry takes a number of examples to bear as we think about this problem that has existed and increasingly exists within a world that moves very quickly, where money is made and lost relatively quickly, and where there isn't a good fix necessarily from all companies as to what people want from the service world, from the goods world, what they expect, and how companies can deliver and meet those changing expectations. And so in Big Bang Disruption, Larry's able to go through a number of theories and ideas that allow us to think through what businesses should be doing and how they can handle these things. As you look in the table of contents, you get both a definitional concept of what Big Bang Disruption is, but then in the second half of the book, there is a focus on how businesses can react through a 12-step plan, and we're not going to talk about all 12 steps today, but through several that I think dovetail very nicely with what we talk about on Hearsay Culture. Because as Hearsay Culture was founded in May 2006, focusing on the intersection of IP and technology, we have increasingly seen that technology itself is not just driving the law, but in fact can supplant the law. So too here, the way businesses have been structured and the way they deal with these disruptive technologies can not only indicate whether that company is going to do well, but what markets look like on a going forward basis. And so when companies think through these issues, as Larry points out, they need to think through things like the dilemma of the innovator. And what this Big Bang Disruption means that we have to rethink not just how management operates, but how lower level management and workers interact, how companies interact between each other, and putting these products into the market while dealing with the changing costs of technology is an extremely challenging thing for most companies to deal with. And so in the book, a strategy is laid out that helps companies at least think that through. So I'm very excited to have Larry on. And Larry, for those that aren't familiar, has been an analyst around the internet world for a number of years. He's focused particularly on disruptive technologies. His first book, Unleashing the Killer App, was a book that kind of set the stage for a lot of what we're talking about here, but also in its own right was allowed companies and thinkers about innovation policy to consider what technology was doing to business models and to business strategy. He's been more recently a columnist for Forbes as well as for CNET. He writes for USA Today, for the Harvard Business Review. He is also, more recently, he's become the project director of Georgetown's Center for Business and Public Policy, and I'm going to ask him a little about that as well. He is joining us via Skype from Berkeley. Larry, thanks for coming back on Hearsay Culture to discuss your new book.
Well, it's my pleasure, David. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Let me start off, Larry. I had you on the show a few years ago, but I think it's helpful to kind of go back in this direction. Talk a little bit more about your background and particularly why you chose to write this book after having authored your earlier works.
Sure. So I have a pretty checkered past, I think is the nice way to put it. I started out as an engineer and then went to law school and did management consulting, so business strategy, economics, law, and policy, and always looking for ways to bring those things together because, of course, increasingly those things do come together and they determine more and more how the economy actually develops and what kind of experience consumers have with technology. So in some ways the world is validating my strange choices of careers and education by bringing them all together. This book came out, I mean, really in some ways this book is what I would think of as a sequel to that first book, to the Killer App book, which came out in 1998. And as you said, it was looking at kind of how the internet was just at that point beginning to really change the rules of business and what kind of things both startups and incumbents could do to take advantage of the wonderful opportunities that the technology provided, as well as to survive the challenges that the same technologies were creating. And Paul and I got together now about 3 years ago, both realizing that, you know, we had both done sort of early work in this area, but that there had been some fairly fundamental shifts, particularly obviously in the last 10 years, as technological disruption continued to accelerate. It was doing so in ways that were new and uncataloged. And so we started a fairly interactive research project, which is still ongoing, by the way. We're still doing the research together at the Accenture Institute for High Performance in Boston, and trying to figure out, you know, was this a particular industry phenomenon? Did it go across industries? Were there any kind of conventional wisdoms about business strategy, marketing, all the other kind of MBA topics that needed a closer examination? And we very quickly came to the conclusion that there was something really fundamental different that had been happening and that was going to continue to happen, and that we could sort of, you know, categorize that and define it and talk about it in a way that we thought would lend itself to a book. So we started out actually with an article a year before in the Harvard Business Review called also Big Bang Disruption. That got a lot of attention. We sort of tried to poke pins in a lot of trial balloons of the business academy. So we kind of annoyed a lot of people and got a lot of attention for that. And then very quickly went to work on taking the research and turning it into the book.
So I mentioned – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Larry. Were you going to answer the answer? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, I thought I heard something there. There we go. Mic feedback. So I mentioned in the introduction, you've got two parts of the book, right? Part one, you titled Big Bang Disruption, where you introduce this concept. And then part two, you have a strategy in the age of devastating innovation. I'm just curious, you know, the relationship between the two parts, is one following on the other? And the reason why I'm asking is, you know, I find the book to have a pretty wide audience between people in the business world and then, you know, people in the academic world or policy world. And I'm curious about your take on the audience or your intended audience for the book. Is it that broad?
Yeah, it's even broader than that. I mean, we're hoping as well for kind of a general nonfiction readership, as all business book writers do. And we're certainly seeing some of that. You know, I think we were both from previous experience as authors as well as readers, we were kind of dissatisfied with the general model that a lot of business books take, which is They're generally just diagnostic. They'll sort of identify a phenomenon and talk about it, but they never really get to the prescriptive part, or if they do, it's just the last chapter, or they kind of just throw it away. It's not usually very compelling. So, you know, we really wanted to address, from the business side, two principal audiences. One would be, you know, kind of traditional incumbents, the kinds of companies that, frankly, my co-author works with most often, which would be, you know, large enterprises who are in, you know, industries, very wide range of industries, who were being disrupted by these new technologies, these new ways of doing things, and hoping that we could address them, as well as the audience of people who are doing startups, people who are entrepreneurs, maybe even individuals, who are likewise trying to figure out what really is the potential of these new technologies. How can they, you know, accelerate the way in which you get into business and develop products and services? How do you fund them? How do you market them? How do you manufacture them? How do you retail them? And those were the two audiences we wanted, and we thought the best way to do that was, as you say, to separate the book into these two parts. And we think about the first half of the book is really the diagnostic. What is the phenomenon? What's causing it? What are the economics behind it? You know, sort of who's inventing the things that are making it happen. And then the second half of the book is the prescriptive part, where we say, all right, now that we've explained to you why your business is being disrupted or why you can be more disruptive, how do you do it? And as you said, we try to use the formulation of rules, and so we have these 12 rules. It's a 12-step program, as you said, for how to take advantage of all the material in the first half of the book. And we think, you know, in lots and lots of examples, that's what the research project was largely addressed to, was finding those examples.
So Larry, let's start off with that top-level question, right? The Big Bang disruption certainly has a ring to it. Define it for us. When you say Big Bang disruption, what are you referring to?
Sure. So we're talking about a product or service that enters the market both better and cheaper than the products of incumbents who are already there. And the better and cheaper is the key here. There's a long, long history of kind of academic writing about business and how disruption happens. And most notably, I think, for many people in your audiences would be the work of Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School. He wrote a very influential book in the late 1990s called The Innovator's Dilemma. And he said, you know, traditionally people used to think, well, innovation came from the top down. You know, if you had luxury vehicles, they would have very high-end, you know, new gadgets and services and devices and things. And ultimately, as you kind of got scale, then you could make them at a lower price, and you could start putting things like, you know, anti-lock brakes and airbags and high-end audio equipment into cheaper and cheaper cars because, you know, you'd pioneered it at the top. And what Christensen said was, well, actually, that's one way, but a way that wasn't being given much attention was from the bottom up. And he said oftentimes what happens is disruptive technologies enter the market as cheaper but crummier alternatives. And one example he didn't use, but I think is the best one to describe this, is you think about the introduction of personal computers. Of course, no one would have imagined in the very early days, you know, these essentially hobbyist kits you put together yourself. They probably didn't work or didn't do anything. No one would have thought that these were anything like competition for, at that point, the dominant computing model of mainframe computers. So, you know, you didn't buy your Radio Shack computer thinking it was going to take down IBM. So it was sort of on this model of being worse but cheaper, certainly much cheaper, but it didn't really do very much. And what Christensen said was over time, what the disruptive innovators did was they used those kind of early markets and the early adopters who were willing to buy these inferior products and learn from them to build better versions of them and kind of creep up a curve of price and performance until sooner or later they were going to be stepping on the toes of the traditional markets of the incumbents, in this case of the sort of large computer makers. And that's, of course, exactly what happened. Ultimately, you know, personal computers have taken over the world now, that the model of individual processing computers in the cloud and in the client server architecture, that's it. You know, the mainframe is really kind of dead now, and it got eaten away at from the bottom. And he said, you know, the risk here is that when they show up, you don't really pay any attention to them because they're no real competition, they're no real threat to you. But that's, he said, the moment when you should start experimenting with them yourself, because ultimately the price and performance is going to improve to the point where they are both better and cheaper. What we found principally when we looked at the last 10 years was there's been so many doublings of the power of computing and what's known as Moore's Law, and the price and the performance both increasing not just incrementally but actually exponentially, that now the innovator's dilemma is really not correct anymore. It's not actually the way disruption happens, because now what happens is when you get this disruptive technology, it often enters the market not only cheaper but also better than the things it's competing against. And, of course, if that means if you were following Professor Christensen's advice to wait until you saw it enter the market before you actually started your own experiments, now that's become very dangerous because, in effect, you've waited too long. When it shows up, it's already better and cheaper than what you've got. You don't have time anymore to wait before you start developing a strategic response. So that we thought was our principal insight, and pretty much everything else in the book really derives from that.
So that gets us, Larry, to another word you and name you use in the book, which are disruptors. So who are disruptors?
Well, the easiest way to answer that, I suppose, is to say they're anybody who's taking advantage of a technology that's both better and cheaper to undermine the existing relationships of an industry or of a particular market. And maybe I, give you a great example from early in the book when we talked about the sort of disruption of the GPS device manufacturer. So, of course, ironically, or maybe not so ironically, the companies who made these standalone GPS devices, a Garmin, TomTom, and Magellan, and so on, they, of course, themselves were a better and cheaper disruptor in some ways to the idea of printed maps. In fact, soon after these standalone devices came on the market, companies like Rand McNally and the Thomas Guide went out of business. After being, in the case of Rand McNally, had been making printed maps, paper maps, for almost 100 years. Well, of course, then the irony is that then they themselves got disrupted by a better and cheaper alternative, which was thanks to the dramatic adoption of smartphone technology and the huge improvements in the quality of 3G and now, of course, 4G broadband mobile networks. Companies like Google and Apple could say, well, look, we already have a platform here. We've already got the device. We've already got the network. We can actually start to offer even better versions of navigation technology, where you get the turn-by-turn directions from a voice-based system. We can just put that on an app on the phone, and, of course, we're not going to charge for it, at least not going to charge directly, because we're going to make our money the way we always do, which is, advertising and collecting information and using that to develop other products. So suddenly, in a matter of days, millions of copies of Google Maps navigation and then later Apple navigation were downloaded to smartphones. And, of course, now there's, a billion or so of those around the world, including now the tablets and all the other mobile devices. And so for the people like Garmin and TomTom and Magellan, waiting again until the moment when the Google Maps navigation was announced, which is what they effectively did, was catastrophic because it was a better and cheaper alternative and one, frankly, that was more convenient, better integrated. If you were doing a search or if you were looking in your address book and you found an address, you just click on it and it takes you directly to the navigation for it. You don't have to re-enter anything. And so from the standpoint of traditional business strategy, it violated this seminal rule, which was you're supposed to never compete in a new product on more than one thing, either price or quality or, focus on a particular set of customer problems. And in fact, the navigation apps did all three at once. And not surprisingly, there was no time after that for the traditional GPS standalone device people to really have any kind of strategic response. They basically just retreated and all the kind of traditional metrics you would think about, their stock price, their sales volume, their profitability, plummeted in the matter of 10 to 18 months, and they've never really recovered from that.
Larry, the impetus for the question, right, which and that example is a good one, is because one of the interesting immediate thoughts I had as I was reading your book is you call into question what competition looks like in today's economy, because as you point out, the disruptors may not view the traditional competitors or the people or the entities you might think are competitors as competitors. Right. So who are the competitors of disruptors? Or maybe a better way to ask the question is, how do you define competition in a big bang disruption scenario?
Well, that's a great question because, as you say, the traditional GPS manufacturers, who did they think was their competition? They thought it was the other GPS device manufacturers. And who did Google think was their competition? It's not, they weren't developing that app to at least not, I think, explicitly to compete with these other devices. They were just doing what they always do, which is we've got a new information service. We're going to, integrate it with all the other ones, and we're going to use that to build up our build up our database of information products and do what we do with everything that we introduce. It's really not thinking about it in traditional competition ways. So, I think the answer to your question is increasingly the competitors that you have, whether you're an incumbent or a startup, isn't so much other companies, whether they're in or out of your existing industry. It's really the technology itself. I mean, that's, I think, the point is that the technology improvements, and by the way, we're going to talk, I'm sure, mostly about information technology and digital technology, but there are other technologies that exhibit this kind of exponential improvement. But when you're working with those kinds of technologies that are so explosive and are continuing to improve even as you're working with them, it's really the technology itself that's become the competition more than the company or the individual or the startup or the entrepreneur or the venture capitalist. Whoever's involved in its deployment is in some ways secondary to the technology itself.
We're chatting with Larry Downs, co-author of the book Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So you, as you just alluded to, and last kind of background question before we, you know, dive into some of the ideas and suggestions that you have in the book, you just alluded to it, but I want to be clear. You heavily focus on consumer electronics, and I think it's useful to explain why. There perhaps are some obvious aspects to it, as you've alluded to, with the smartphone and its ability to, you know, to create improved abilities for human beings to walk around with the power in their hand to do things that, you know, even, you know, 10 years ago were incapably done on a phone. But I think it's deeper than that. So, you know, what is going on in a consumer electronics market that makes Big Bang Disruption as a theory have a lot of currency?
Sure. So, and it's true, many, although, you know, not a majority, but many of the examples in the book do come from the world of consumer electronics as well as gaming, entertainment, and computing itself. And in one sense, it's not a big surprise. These, of course, always have been very hyper-competitive industries, and, of course, industries where, because this increasing price and performance improvement accelerating in the core technologies, it's not surprising that, you know, we now have this environment where every year the sort of next generation of smartphones show up, and they're better and cheaper than the previous generation. And it's cheap enough because we're making them in such high volume that many consumers can toss them after a year or two and upgrade, that is to say, get a better and cheaper version of what they had. That happens in gaming, that happens in computing, and it happens in a lot of entertainment. I think another reason why that's the sort of the set of industries that exhibit these characteristics most obviously is because, of course, of software. Not all, but many of the examples we talk about take the form of software, and software, as you know, has some very unique economic properties. It can be effectively reproduced, manufactured at zero marginal cost. And so if you get a piece of software that people like and you've bundled it up in some way, it's now a product or a service, and if consumers like it, you effectively can make as many as you want because it doesn't cost anything to make them, and you can make them kind of indefinitely. Many times you get the customers themselves, you know, they do the download, they do the install, they're using their own devices, their own networks that they're paying for service to do the manufacturing for you, in effect. And so if you've got a better and cheaper product that's taking the form of software, you can deploy it, you can sell it, you can license it, you can market it to millions, in fact, in some cases, hundreds of millions of consumers in an incredibly short amount of time. A great example of that recently was, of course, the acquisition of WhatsApp, which is the IP-based text messaging service that was acquired for a price that made approach $19 billion when all is said and done. And you know, what was it about that piece of software that made it so compelling? There were many, in fact, there still are many alternative and competing apps that do much of the same thing. But I think the difference was for WhatsApp was they were on this incredible trajectory of going from 10 million users in the first year, I think, to something close to 400 million users in their third year of existence. And the trajectory puts them at a track to be a billion users in another couple of years. That's, you know, it's a kind of becomes like a form of gravity. And it's something you see in its purest form when you're talking about software and electronics and computing. But, of course, increasingly, as we say, you know, you don't get a free pass just because you're not in those industries, because whatever industry you're in, increasingly the products or services you deal with are themselves involved with software and with computing and with the, you know, pieces that come out of smartphone production that get reused into other things. So, in fact, everybody's now in the computing or consumer electronics business to one extent or another, and increasingly they're becoming more part of that business. And so that kind of phenomenon of just, you know, hyper competition and instant consumer adoption and frankly instant consumer rejection when they find the next big thing, these are phenomena that are increasingly going to apply to industries that were traditionally thought of being far, far away from computers and consumer electronics.
Larry, when one of the things you do in the book, which I think is really helpful, you know, to think about the life of a product, if you will, as you point out early on in the book, is you know, most people are familiar, or at least a lot of people are familiar with the classic bell curve that Everett Rogers put together of consumer segments. Certainly people that are, you know, familiar with business theory, where you have innovators and then you move through people that adopt, and finally you have people at the, you know, the laggards at the end who, you know, are you know, come in kicking and screaming. You in the book have condensed that curve really down to two segments of trial users and everyone else. And I'm curious to get your thoughts as to how you come to that, and if that model applies across the board whenever you have a big bang disruption.
Right. So that is the key. It's obviously the sort of traditional nicely shaped bell curve of market adoption hasn't gone away entirely, although increasingly it's what we're seeing. And yes, it really is tied to this phenomenon of better and cheaper disruptive innovations. When you've got that, what you'll see is that when the market moves to a new product or service, they move as a group. They're no longer these neatly defined segments anymore that each have different values and each have a different marketing message. Part of it is, I think, another aspect of the technology itself, which is the advent of social media and social buying and all the things that go with it, is that consumers increasingly get their information about products and services from each other. You know, marketing, kind of traditional marketing, broadcast or one-directional marketing, people obviously are still doing it, but it's not as powerful as it was, because now consumers have these tools to tell each other, hey, you know, this is the time to buy an HDTV. It's really now reached that point. Or as we talk about in the book, this is the time to buy an ebook reader. There were a decade of complete failures before the Amazon Kindle. And when the, you know, consumers realized they got the right set of technologies together at the right price with the right business model, then everybody, you know, millions of people went from zero to millions in a very, very short period of time. We refer to that in the book, that phenomenon is what we call near-perfect market information. The market now talks to itself, the consumers talk to themselves, and so this has driven this very squashed and stretched bell curve that we call the shark fin, where once consumers decide as a group that the better and cheaper innovation has arrived, they will move as a single group, and often in a very, very short period of time.
We're chatting with Larry Downs, a co-author of the book Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation, on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that we're on KCSU-FM, which is a non-commercial radio station and a non-profit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KCSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kcsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kcsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KCSU. Regardless, I hope you continue to listen. So Larry, I want to talk to you, you know, in our second half a bit about the role of law before we get into the 12 rules that you lay out, and I'll ask you to kind of briefly summarize those before we dig into a few. But before I do that, you know, I wanted to kick around really two industries. Of sorts, one, you know, both very personal to Hearsay Culture, and kind of get your reaction to how your insights might apply there. The first one, and actually, you know, relates to consumer economics, but and consumer markets and consumer electronics, which is the medium we're on now. You know, I just read off call letters for a radio station. Call letters for radio stations goes back literally decades to the earliest days of radio, and yet Hearsay Culture, while it's on KZSU, immediately becomes a podcast, right, and can be streamed on the internet where radio stations operate and sometimes struggle, and then enters the podcast world, which has absolutely nothing to do with that traditional broadcast medium. Would you say, and I recognize that this moves a little bit afield, but would you say that even the advent of the podcast operating as it does in tandem with radio is a big bang disruption? And if so, has the traditional world of radio and broadcast media handled it well?
Well, the second part of the question is easier.
Yeah, see, I know it's an easy one. I was curious how you'd set it up.
I think the first half of your question, I don't know that it's, I think it's part of a series of Big Bang disruptors, and I wouldn't limit it even just to radio and broadcast. I would say everything having to do with content, which in some ways is saying everything having to do with information. The real shift here, and it is a seismic shift of historical consequences, is from the world of physical media to the world of digital media. As Nicholas Negroponte so famously said so long ago, bits are bits. And once information takes the form of digital content, takes the form of bits, then you can do whatever you want with it. You can repurpose it for any media, including media that haven't been invented yet, and distribute it, you know, slice and dice it, remix it, whatever it is you're going to do with it. Effectively, the cost now goes to manufacturing, of distribution, go down to almost nothing. And of course, that really puts tremendous pressure on traditional media businesses, newspapers, magazines, books, radio, television. All those things were considered to be silos where once the information, you know, once you put the information into a book, it's extremely hard to get it out and put it into something else. So once you broadcast a program over the radio, it's sort of done. You can't, you know, you've done it. That particular implementation of the information was over. Well, now, of course, because it starts life as bits, we can repurpose it, combine it with other content, you know, mixed media, whatever it is we want to do. That's really been, I think, the Big Bang disruption, and it applies to every industry in the sort of, you know, general category of content business, which is an enormous part, of course, of the economy, particularly in the United States, which has long been a powerhouse of creating content. What we haven't yet sorted out is the new models for delivering that content and monetizing that content. Of course, a lot of what happens today is in the form of experiments, things like, you know, as you say, podcasting as an alternative, or over-the-top internet-based television channels. All these things that are happening are certainly experimenting with new ways of either of distributing content, of creating the content, or of monetizing the content. But, you know, we have industries that were so built around the media themselves. You know, you think of newspapers, and we talk about, you know, television stations or radio stations. The name in and of itself kind of focuses on the media that was used to deliver it. And when you now separate the media from the content, that's throwing things into a lot of chaos. And it's not surprising that it's taken a long time to figure out, you know, what are the new models. I think ultimately we can be confident that whatever the new models are, they're going to be better for everybody, because again, if you can create this stuff and distribute it more inexpensively and reuse it much more effectively, then obviously the opportunities for new products and services goes up exponentially. And that, I think, is the sort of saving grace for the media and content industries. But it's you know, it's a change that takes at least one generation of managers to accomplish.
And Larry, you know, I actually do want to ask you about experimentation shortly, because of course that's been the hallmark of business since, you know, really since the beginning of business, but it differs today. The kind of a transitional question. I'm asking you these kind of, you know, very specific, you know, segmented questions, because I'm curious about the broad applicability of the theory, because another, you know, another example here, you know, might very well be the world that I am in and that you are in by virtue of your affiliation with the Georgetown Center, which is education. You know, law schools are, you know, and it's fairly well known now, are dealing with very significant challenges, as the market has shifted radically, and it's been a shift that's more challenging by virtue primarily of the fact that applications of law schools have dropped significantly over the last several years. And so I'm curious again, you know, from a Big Bang disruption standpoint, right? If you know, we certainly are aware of the fact that technologies again exist for, you know, the massive online courses and so forth. But online education is hardly the norm at this point. You know, for a law school looking at the challenges that it faces now. I don't want to get to your steps just yet, although I certainly won't limit you if you want to go in that direction now. But what do you say from a theoretical standpoint to legal education writ large as it deals with these changes that quite frankly many schools have been slow to address.
Right. So I think, and by the way, I'll preface this by saying that when I was doing consulting, which I really don't do anymore, there were sort of two industries I always said I would never work in. One was education and the other was airline transportation. Because I don't think either of them are solvable problems. But that's just being obnoxious. I think, look, the thing for legal education that you have to understand is that it's really kind of experiencing a double whammy. Of Big Bang disruptions. There are really two things that are affecting it. One is kind of the breakdown of education itself, and that's a general problem. Again, it's another one of these shifts from atoms to bits, where we thought about education as being very, it's about the university, it's about the buildings, it's about the library and the books and the, ivy-covered walls and so on. It was one, of course, in which you had very, very limited supply because you could only have as many students as you had physical space for them on campus, and so you could kind of operate in a way that recognized in the law of supply and demand. You had limited supply, and that of course was one easy way to manage pricing and demand. As education, as you say, is moving from the world of the physical to the world of the bits. The good news is, of course, 99% of the people who couldn't afford or couldn't get into these very limited but very high bandwidth educational institutions now have access to comparable products at a price that's free in some cases, so much more attractive, and that's putting a lot of pressure just on the business model, if you will, of traditional campus-based education. The second double whammy here, though, is that what's going on to legal profession itself, right? So one of the reasons that demand for a place in law school is down is because there's a crisis in the practice of law as well. And so we often say, your own disruption is not often as important as the disruption to your customers in their businesses or to your suppliers in their businesses. So here we've got, again, legal profession as a professional service was one that artificially limits supply of lawyers. And so that keeps prices high, but it leaves a tremendous amount of unserved demand. And so, again, 99% of people can't afford a lawyer for whatever thing that they've got. And so that's put a lot of pressure for technologically based disruptions to enter into the legal market and say, well, this model is grossly inefficient, billing by the hour, all these sort of things that law firms do to kind of, maximize profit over actual demand. Is no longer really working. And so again, we've got a whole list of technological disruptors coming in to the legal field as well as to the educational field. And now both industries are in crisis. And so if you're in legal education, you're kind of at the intersection of both of those crises.
So we're chatting with Larry Downs, author of the book Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I'm Larry. We have so far focused primarily on the first half of your book. I do want to take the time here to focus on the second half, where you are admirably not only diagnosing a problem, but suggesting, I think, some really interesting and thoughtful ways to address it as a profit-making entity. I could say to you, tell us about your 12 steps, and then I could leave and have a sandwich and, take a nap, and you could just keep going. So instead, what I'm going to do this is about as typical as I get with a typical radio interview. I'm going to say, give us the broad strokes overview in 4 or 5 minutes, maybe at tops, of what those 12 steps are. And then I really want to drill down on a few of them in particular.
Sure. So we divide, you mentioned earlier the Everett Rogers bell curve and the different segments that Rogers talked about. So in our alternative version of that, we call the shark fin. As you said, we only have two kinds of users, the trial users and everybody else, but we actually took that very shortened bell curve and divided it into four sort of sequential stages, and we thought that was meaningful. So in some ways, the 12 rules, they're really kind of, we give three for each of these stages. So we talk about, for example, the early stage being what we call the singularity, where there's the disruptive technology hasn't quite reached this price performance magic moment, and you see all these different experiments of people trying to figure out how to put it together, you know, interesting combination of technology and combination of business model, and, you know, ultimately, you know, develop WhatsApp or ultimately develop Google Maps, Navigate, whatever the thing is that finally, the e-Kindle, whatever the thing that finally gets the right combination. And then the three stages that follow that, one, the next one is the Big Bang itself, where, again, that's when the entire market at once realizes, hey, this is a good thing, everybody jumps to it, and then the next stage, you know, of course, since everybody jumped to it very quickly, then, you know, you've exhausted your market potential also very quickly. And so when the next disruptor comes along, the fallout, the drop-off, is also very dramatic. We call that the big crunch. These, of course, all metaphorical terms we're taking from the Big Bang theory of the universe. And then the final stage is where you have sort of some industries or some companies that are still left serving the old technology to some old customers. We call that entropy. It's sort of the end of the line. And in some cases, it's still a profitable business, but many times it's just people who are stuck there, like the U.S. Postal Service. By law, they have to continue delivering mail, even if no one wants it, and no one's actually, you know, sending it anymore, which is why they lose, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So the 12 rules are divided, for each of those four stages. And, you know, they're really aimed at sort of thinking about business strategy in a different way. Some of them have to do with product development. Some of them have to do with marketing. Some of them have to do with production and distribution and retailing. Some of them have to do with you know, investing and sort of fundraising and equity. And then, you know, some of them have to do with you know, at the end, how you use your intellectual property and your other assets to get out of a dying business and kind of relocate to some other singularity.
So let's talk about a few of these particular areas, Larry, because I think there's, like I said, I think there's a lot there. So, you know, the first, literally, the first step you have in this process addresses directly this issue of information access and information control. And so you begin the discussion, strategy in the age of devastating innovation, by talking about the question of when you enter the market and how you enter the market. And throughout that entire discussion is rule number one, consult your truth tellers. So who are the truth tellers? And again, I mean, and this dovetails heavily with the issues that we talk about in Hearsay Culture with regard to information technology, as you predicted we'd be talking about. Who are the truth tellers and how do they get access to the information they need to speak the truth to the people who are making these decisions?
Right. Okay. So, and I should start by saying that the term truth teller, you know, again, we're very snarky sometimes.
Yes.
That term actually comes from the world of soap operas.
Yes.
The truth teller is the character in the soap opera whose job it is to kind of move the plot along more quickly. And things will languish for months and then suddenly, you know, Aunt Phyllis will show up, or I should use a real example. In Downton Abbey, Mrs. Hughes will show up. She's the truth teller there and say, well, you know, by the way, you know, he's your actual brother, or, you know, that's not your father, or there's another child, or, you know, like when Yoda said, there's another Skywalker in the Star Wars movies. That's the sort of the idea here. And what we found was that even in industries that had been very mature for a very long time, just before they went through their big chaotic moment, one great example we use in the book was the decline and really the end of pinball machines at the hands of home video games. What we often found was there was always one or two people who seemed way ahead of time to see what we call the inevitable truth, that yes, you know, there are going to be all these incremental stages, and, you know, Netflix is going to send out the DVDs by mail, but that's not really where that business was going, and some people knew right from the beginning that ultimately, when the networks were fast enough and the price was low enough, it would be obviously digitally distributing and streaming them over broadband networks and watch that way, that the sort of mailing of media was only an interim step. And some people saw that, and, you know, some people at Netflix saw that, some people at Blockbuster didn't see that. They thought, well, this is not much real competition for us. because they didn't see the inevitable truth. And so we found there were all those, and interesting enough, that those people, there was no real common link who those people were. Sometimes they were very senior people in the industry, so, you know, obviously a classic example would be someone like Steve Jobs, who just always seemed to see where things were going two steps further than where he was actually taking them in any particular product. But sometimes they were outside the industry. They were customers. They were, you know, engineers who had been working in the industry for a long time. Sometimes they were science fiction writers. A lot of the, you know, a lot of the smartphone technology was predicted and seen, you know, by people writing Star Trek episodes. And in some ways, the, you know, the fiction became the truth. So it's not really clear to us, frankly, where they come from and what makes them different. But we know that they're there. And that really the hard part we found, particularly for the incumbent businesses who didn't make the transition, let's say a Kodak versus a Fujifilm in the transition from film photography to digital photography, it wasn't the difference between who survived and who didn't wasn't which ones had a truth teller. It was which ones listened to the truth teller.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key part of this message is finding them isn't so hard. Listening to them is hard, and essentially, because often they're telling you something very unpleasant. They're saying, look, the assets you've got right now that you've cherished and nurtured and you think are your source of long-term competition value, they're not. Those are now liabilities. Now, you have other assets, by the way, but, you know, you're going to have to make some very significant cultural shifts and management shifts and frankly, employment and resource shifts as well. That's a very unpleasant thing to hear, even when you sort of in your heart know they're probably telling you the truth. So when we say listen to the truth tellers, the point of it is not that, you know, they're hard to find. The point is they're hard to accept.
And Larry, I should mention, we're now well into the unfair portion of the show where I start asking you questions that you don't have time to answer adequately in the time we have left, and then I ask the question anyway, hence the unfair part, which gets to a related question here, which is a thread running through your book, which is the challenge between corporate secrecy and openness. I've had on the show a couple of times Hank Chesbro and his work involving open innovation, and I'm curious, you know, how you see the role of openness versus secrecy in the strategy that you outline, and where the law comes in on these issues. So you can take either part first.
When you say the law, you mean the real law, not
I mean the actual yes, the actual traditional law that law schools teach.
Yeah. So we definitely are in the camp, I think, you know, with some reservations, which we don't have time to talk about. But basically, we believe that the economics of research and development have changed because of this because of the cloud and because of access to consumers, because of the ability to experiment, all these things. What really happens here is that now the cost of innovating out in the open, you can call it open innovation, you can call it lean, you can call it agile. Doing it with real customers, you know, using Kickstarter, other platforms to fund it, whatever it is, the economics of that have improved to the point where the benefits of kind of closed, secret, proprietary research and development are really diminishing very rapidly. What you get in terms of speed and access and sort of direct collaboration with consumers from doing it out in the open have now kind of reached a tipping point where they've tipped the balance on the other side. And how that relates to law, I mean, one of the, of course, the big messages of the book is that industries that have really relied for a long time on legal protections to keep competitors, new entrants, new technologies away, whether that's in the form of intellectual property, you know, patents, copyrights, trademarks, or whether that's in the form of literal regulation if you're in the energy business or you're in the taxi cab business, you're in healthcare and so on. Those protections certainly put off the entry of disruptors, and they certainly slow the timing for Big Bang disruption. But on the other side, once they finally do crack the code and get in and they've got consumers behind them, the transformation in those industries is actually even more chaotic than the ones that happen more naturally.
So, Larry, that kind of gets to this issue of experimentation, which I think is fascinating that you discuss in the book. You know, as you were talking about it earlier, I was thinking about what an issue which has just arisen in the last couple of days involving the legal textbook publisher Aspen and their project Textbook Connect, I think is what they're calling it, or Aspen Connect. But the idea is that rather than purchasing a textbook, students will be able to effectively license the textbook, and they have to return it at the end of a semester, but they get access to online content. This, as you might imagine, has caused many people in the particularly copyright scholars to be very concerned about first sale doctrine issues and issues of the ability of students to hold on to books and hold on to textbooks or resell them and stuff like that. But my question is not copyright law for you. My question is this experimentation, right? It, at least to me, Aspen is clearly attempting to experiment with a new model to deal with, as we've alluded to earlier, the challenges the publishing industry faces. And experimentation has always been the focus of the world of innovation generally. And we have law in patents that allow for experimentation, even public experimentation without losing protection, and so forth. How is experimentation different today? And am I using with this Aspen situation, as I've described it, and I recognize it's a new issue now, so you can take my facts as I present them, but how is experimentation different today versus prior to these technologies being in the market?
Yeah, so I think the big difference with what we talk about is seemingly random market experiments is that the price now of actually launching a trial product in the market is, especially if there's any kind of information component to it, which in your hypothetical or your not hypothetical, is clearly the case. The cost, literally, and the risk of launching such an experiment is almost nothing. You can build a piece of software, you can launch a new business model with real customers. Everything is done in the cloud, and everything is done with software. You can fund it, of course, if you're a startup, as I said before, with a crowdsourcing platform. And so you see this amazing explosion of experiments all trying to figure out, in the case of your example, is there a better and cheaper way of, we don't think about the books anymore. The book, again, as I said before, that's the media. We don't care about the media. We care about the message, which is the information. And is there a better way to deliver that information? Is there a more cost-effective way, both for the producer and the consumer of that information? And is there a kind of a way of using the technology to greatly improve everybody's performance and everybody's financial performance? That's the kind of experimentation that we're talking about.
So, Larry, I'm going to ask you this kind of, closing question, if you will. I mean, there's so much here to talk about. We can't do all of it. But you mentioned the broad audience that you'd like to see this book address, and I agree that I think it's very readable. So cabining it as a business book is, as I agree, too narrow. But as you imagine I'm just going to posit this, right? The middle level manager at a company that's established but is dealing with these issues, who picks up the book and says, okay, what am I going to take out of this that I can walk into the next day and do immediately? Is there something here in your strategy that you think can be implemented, in the proverbial tomorrow, as opposed to things that take more time and more ability to build in to a business model?
Sure. It's a great question, and we get asked it all the time. Especially as we're sort of now out on the hustings here, talking about the book to a wide variety of audiences in different industries. I think the thing that always strikes me is the one thing that can always be done immediately, and I'm always amazed at how rarely that's the case, is to just even be aware of these experiments. So we give a lot of examples here of very large companies. One of the ways in which you find out what are the new tech, what are the potentially disruptive tech, if you can't wait now anymore until they show up in the market, how do you know about them early enough to develop a strategy? And of course, it turns out it's very easy. It's very cheap to find out what people are doing just by watching other experiments. So it's amazing how many CEOs we talk to who have never heard of Kickstarter. They don't understand. They can't believe that it's that easy now to get funding for a project. We always encourage everybody you know, again, how many CEOs have never heard of hackathons, don't understand that you can just kind of, you know, throw a little money in the pot and get a bunch of people to come together for a short period of time, play around with a problem, see what they can come up with in 48 hours, and if something interesting arises, you know, then you know you can take that to the next level. And it's astonishing to find out, you know, again, people at very large multi-million-dollar enterprises who aren't aware that that kind of mentality, that kind of culture is thriving really around the world, and how easy it is to tap into it, really just show up or pay attention to it. That would get many of the incumbents that we looked at who failed probably would have gotten a lot further, if not survived, if only they had just paid the slightest attention to what was going on right in plain view.
Larry Downes, co-author of the book Big Bang Disruption, Strategy in the Age of Devastating Innovation. You can not only purchase the book, but you can also read his writing on Forbes and in other venues. Larry, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. I really enjoyed reading the book, and it's one that I think there's a lot of stuff to think through, again, both from a scholarly and theoretical perspective as well as a very practical and business-oriented perspective. So thank you for joining us today on the show.
Well, thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
I'm happy to mention a number of guests coming up as we round out this quarter on Hearsay Culture's schedule. Coming up next week, Professor Evan Selinger of the Rochester Institute of Technology on technology and the human experience. Following that, another area, speaking of Big Bang disruptions, Professors Ryan Kahlo of the University of Washington School of Law and Woody Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law on this really minor question of robotics and the law. And I say that, of course, tongue-in-cheek. I mean, this is a huge disruption and one that I'm thrilled to have two leading thinkers in that space on the show to talk about it. And then rounding out the end of the spring quarter, Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch & Schultz, LLP, on drone technology and freedom of information. Again, drones, I think of drones anyway as a subset of robotics, although there are different characteristics to both. At any rate, I'm thrilled and excited to talk to Nabiha coming up. I am in the process of starting to send out invitations for the summer quarter on Hearsay Culture. For those of you that have listened regularly, during the interim period on KZSU's schedule, which is roughly a 3 to 4 week period, three times a year, I don't do new shows. So after June 4th, we pretty much won't have shows on or new shows on until late June. So I'm in the process of booking guests for the summer. And to that end, if you have any suggestions on people that you'd like to hear on the show, please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a couple of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. This quarter, 2 p.m. Pacific Time, Wednesdays at KZSU or by streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, and also the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. So I hope you've enjoyed today's discussion. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.